What is Swansea? Is it an animal?
It's a place.
It don't sound near.
It's in Wales.
Oh, mate, they say it's well grim up north.
Are Wales and the north of England really as grim as Jabe from the London-based sitcom The Inbetweeners believes? And if so, why? A controversial new paper suggests that the UK's north-south divide has been caused by a brain drain that's been going on for 200 years. Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of interviews with some of the world's leading economists. My name is Tim Phillips, and today I've come to the London School of Economics to talk to Neil Cummins, one of the authors of a new CEPR discussion paper called The Big Sort. His co-author is Greg Clark of the University of California, Davis. They've researched two centuries of migration from the north of England and Wales to the south and reached the startling conclusion that the economic decline of these regions happened because the people with the highest ability left. Neil, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hi, Tim.
Our listeners in the north and Wales are already shouting abuse at you. So are you sure you got this one right?
There are several things to point out right off the bat. The first is that this paper collects a large number of separately constructed big data sets, and it applies a very simple test. So if we're wrong on methodological grounds, if we're wrong on data grounds, we have multiple sanity catches for that. So the paper and analysis are very simple. The data is large and varied. Further, we have toured this for about a year and a half at dozens of academic conferences with very bright people in the audience. Now, as you alluded to, the paper generates a reaction. But if we're wrong, the cream of the crop of academic economists can't tell us why.
Okay, for non-Brits, can you put some numbers on the scale of this north-south divide?
So the English north-south divide is long-standing and echoes some other regional divides across the world. The differences are quite stark. In terms of any measure of economic productivity, the south is more productive and richer than the north. In terms of gross value added per person, it's about 33% higher in the south. Oxford, Cambridge offers per students coming from the north or south, they're about double in the south. House prices are at least double in the south these days, and also it's reflected in the share of public sector employment. And finally, I can point to the fact that people in the south just live an extra few years, in the region of 2.5 years, relative to their northern cousins.
There are two narratives on why these regional differences exist. Can you explain these competing ideas?
So the paper takes the approach of trying to simplify existing explanations for the divergence of the north and south of England. And quite starkly, we look at a geographic hypothesis, and that is the idea that there's some sort of failure in the north. There's some sort of distortion to economic efficiency. And our mechanism, our analysis in the paper is designed to pick that up. What we compare that against is just this simple idea that all of this regional inequality is just caused by sorting of different people leaving the north and different people staying.
To test these hypotheses, you've used ancestral names. So how does this work?
It turns out in England that we've got a large number of surnames. We've got nearly 500,000 surnames existing from the first censuses of the early 19th century to the ONS surveys of surname frequency in the past few years. Now, of those 500,000, about 200,000 represent real families. It turns out that you can track people very successfully over time using surnames. Now, for very common surnames, Smith, Clark, Taylor, they're not really giving you much value. But most names are not that common. And there's information content in anybody's name once you get past those most frequent names. So if you look at England in, say, the 1840s, it turns out that some names are highly concentrated in the north and some are highly concentrated in the south. So by assigning those names as being ancestrally north or ancestrally south, we're able to track them through our data sets, which consist of complete population registers and complete probate data over the 100 century and a half since the mid 19th century. An analogy is that if you think of a bacteria dish and staining bacteria to track where it's going to move, in many ways you've got lineages. You can track these families over time by marking them based on the fantastic data that's now available.
I can see that this would contain information 100, 150 years ago. But really, does this have any information that's relevant today? People have moved around so much.
That's a good question. But so basically, it's an empirical question. And you can track how far people have moved because we observe them all the way up to the present day. So part of this project was to digitize the entire birth, marriage and death register of England and Wales since 1838. So you've got this very live tracker of where people are. Most ancestral northerners are still in the north. What's happening is that many have moved south, many have moved abroad, but people seem to have some sort of gravity towards staying in their local area. Family connections, maybe ancestral preferences for climate are still with us. We can show that very emphatically. In fact, that's what the paper is about, just painting that empirical picture.
You also, by using male names, are only tracking half of the population. Does this matter?
It's another very good question. The implicit assumption here is that the marriage market is highly assortative. If that's symmetrical, then we only need to track the male line. And that's kind of one of our implicit assumptions, something that I think people should push us harder on. But I think, again, it's an empirical matter. So a parallel project with this will be to look at the degree of assortative mating in England since 1838, so we can answer that question. I can tell you, we've been working on this for over 10 years. We've looked at these things underneath the hood, and our impression is that while there might be certain gender differences in the marriage market, we fully believe that just capturing the male line is doing the job.
So, by looking at names, what did you discover?
It's fascinating. When you look at this, and because the test is so simple and the data is so strong, the patterns are very striking and simple. Since the records begin in the mid-19th century, migration out of the north has been strongly selected. There has been an elite group of northerners who have moved south to the south and to London. What's striking is that these guys, and women too, are doing stunningly well. They're doing so well that when you track them as a people, there's no disadvantage of people who are from the north in terms of their outcomes. In fact, playing around with the data, the northerners might actually do a little bit better on average than the southerners. And that pattern the strength of it was surprising. But what's also interesting is that there has been this symmetrical mirror image migration from the south to the north. The less elite southerners have moved to the north, balancing out these kind of outcomes for people who are from this region. Remember, those observational inequalities that we talked about at the start of this interview, Oxbridge offers, value added per person, they're all based on where we see people post-shuffle. Right? What we do is we're able to track people from their origins to their destination. And once you track people correctly from their origins, there is no regional inequality in England.
Why did this big salt start?
That is the million-dollar question. We don't know is the simple answer. The various hypotheses that we've discussed involve the type of industry that grew up in the north at the time of the Industrial Revolution. Remember, the north had higher wages than the south during that era when it was the crucible of industrialization, the explosion of Manchester from nothing to being a big industrial exporting city. But basically, the type of production that was specialized in there was low-skill, factory-based, routine work. And it seems that the casual inspection of English history is that if you want to have long-standing economic development in a region, don't specialise in low-skill economic activity. Another example, you know, cities like Detroit in the United States, where activity comes for a generation then leaves very suddenly. Whereas in the South, we always had the legal centre, the centre of administration, the centre of finance, and the South has continued to be this centre of global economic activity. Of course, we know that Northerners are fantastically economically talented. They just move and they go where the jobs are.
So if I understand, your argument is that for a person of a particular ability, their outcomes would on average be the same, whether they're born in the North or born in the South. Now,
ability is notoriously difficult to define in economics. So how do you define it?
That's another good question. That, by the way, that is exactly what we're saying. And I think in terms of defining ability, what we've got in terms of the data is not just the complete population level data. We've got like detailed lineages of family histories. So we've got multiple different levels to assigning what a person's ability might be. So we've multiple measures of outcomes and status, education, occupation, and wealth, of course. But what we observe in a bigger way to get at what I think you're hinting at is family background. Now, of course, people can come from anywhere and do anything. There's nothing kind of condemning about this analysis, but probabilistically, at the average, knowing someone's family origins will explain a lot of the variance in outcomes. And so by controlling for people's family origins, we can say at the average that controlling for ability, people are not disadvantaged in any way.
One of the most striking outcomes from this and the conclusion that you draw is that further regional aid to the north and Wales, or aid to help northerners migrate south, is, as you put it, a misallocation of resources. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And I've seen the reaction. I've seen this look on your face before, right? And here's my reaction to this. This seems to be a peculiarly Darwinian right-wing statement. That's a mistake to interpret it this way. As a society, we care about inequality. We care about redistribution. The point of this paper is that if you are justifying regional spending on observable inequality between the north and south, that is a mistake. Doing that is basically biasing spending towards a certain type of person as opposed to another type of person who might be just as poor and have suffered other sources of disadvantage in their life. And the idea is that there are poor people in the south who are not getting the support that is going to help people in the north. So if you want to kind of spend 50 billion on a new train line, and the justification is because of differential mortality rates, differential wealth rates, differential education levels, that's a mistake. That's dishonest. You've got to say you're doing that because you want to help the north for some other reason, not because of observable inequality. Inequality matters, and we should have a redistributive policy towards it, but it should be based on truth and opportunities, not just based on the handiness of observing them at a regional level, because that's the level we calculate statistics at. If we calculate statistics at the level of skin colour or accent pitch, you'll get different numbers. Okay, which one should we pick? Again, just to reemphasise, the conclusion of this paper is that regional inequality is an artificial observation just from the accident of the construction of geographic regions. Opportunities are equal in England. And by looking at the history of the individual English, using all the data at our disposal, there is no reason to spend any money on any regional policy to correct that.
And just to be clear, the 50 billion on a train line is money that has been allocated for HS2. There are also many other political initiatives to develop the north. Have you had any response from policymakers? Because what you say is unpalatable politically.
Absolutely. There's a danger that people can see the conclusion and be affected in a kind of emotional way to what the message is. I can only encourage people to read the paper closely. My background is not to dismiss any sort of redistribution. I believe that we should redistribute to people who are disadvantaged, but we should do it for real reasons, not just handy emotional geographic based reasons that don't correspond to the actuality of disadvantage of opportunity between people on this island.
And so, Neil, in this situation and in equivalent big sorts that are going on around the world, you mentioned a couple of them already, what should governments do?
Well, in a way, there isn't really much that a government should do. I mentioned the reactions we've been getting in the academic community. I've seen the initial reaction, which generally gives way once people understand exactly what we're saying. But the other reaction is intellectually. This is exactly what models of migration in the 1950s predicted would happen in a toy economy. So Roy, and then later expanded by people like George Boreas, expanded on these types of models of migration where you just get a sort of migration of high skill going to a high skill area where the cost of living is higher and then a low skill going to a low skill area specializing in those types of production. It's perfectly consistent with that. Now, we didn't have the wage data to test that model explicitly, but if that's what's going on, that's the nature of the modern economy. You know, the nature of economic development today requires the government to kind of just let things happen. So together with a redistributive policy that is focused on equity based on real disadvantages between people, the government can play, I think, a limited role, and I think it can just get out of the way.
Neil, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
And a reminder that the CEPR discussion papers called The Big Sort, Selective Migration and the Decline of Northern England, 1780 to 2018. It's number 13023 if you're Googling it. And there's a shorter Vox EU column with the same name. I've got a feeling this isn't the end of this debate. I think you have the same feeling, don't you, Neil?
Oh, absolutely.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. You can now find Vox Talks on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast provider is. And of course, the entire back catalogue's available at voxeu.org/vox-talks.